Welcome to Talking Precision Medicine, the podcast in which we discuss the future of healthcare and health technology, and how advances in data and data science are fueling the next industrial revolution. In this episode, Geniala CEO Raphael Rosengarten speaks with Boston Consulting Group management consultant and healthcare innovation expert Amy McDougall. They discuss emerging trends in healthcare, the role of AI, ethics, and more, as well as BCG's recently released 50 Most Innovative Companies list. Come on in and have a listen.
So it's my distinct pleasure today to be chatting with an old friend of mine, Amy Hurwitz, or Amy McDougall Hurwitz. She and I were at Baylor College of Medicine together years ago, but today Amy works at Boston Consulting Group. And that's all I'm going to say by way of introduction. Amy, can you introduce yourself and your current role at BCG?
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Raphael. And it's such a pleasure to be talking with you today and a blast from the past from our time at Baylor College of Medicine. So my name is Amy McDougall. Recently I moved to my married name, so still getting used to that. And I'm a principal in the Los Angeles office of the Boston Consulting Group. And I've been with the firm for about 6.5 years now and do all of my work in our corporate finance and strategy practice area. And industry-wise, with a focus on healthcare and specifically med tech and biopharma. The background, what led me to that is, as Raphael mentioned, prior to BCG, I did my PhD in molecular medicine and translational biology. And we may talk about this later on, but through a lot of different interests of mine, it led me towards management consulting at BCG.
You know, I was going to save this for later, but let's get into it a little bit. So when we were at Baylor College of Medicine, you were deeply involved in sort of the student entrepreneurship scene there. And so, you know, you clearly had a real passion for this idea of company building and commercialization coming out of healthcare. What was the job search like back in, it would have been the mid-teens probably, leaving Baylor College of Medicine with an academic degree and thinking about what to do next?
Yeah, going into the PhD program at Baylor, it was a very unique program with a focus on bench to bedside. So we had to have a clinical application or a view towards how our thesis work would ultimately impact the clinic. So that application is what attracted me to the program in the first place. And then even further, I knew right away I wanted to be involved somehow in the commercialization of those new discoveries. So through the course of my graduate school tenure, I didn't really know what the job opportunities would look like as a scientist, loving the science, the research, but having some role in its commercialization. And so, I founded a group called Inventure that helped to, translate new discoveries from the bench to bedside to market. And through that discovery process, I found incredible entrepreneurial opportunities and community in Houston. And I also found management consulting. So in my job search later in my graduate school years, as a true pre-consultant, I had a three-pronged strategy. So step one was let me pursue this thing called consulting and see where it takes me, because the recruitment cycle is super early and you get offers for a year out. So that seemed like a reasonable step one. Phase two was going to be look at sort of business development opportunities in pharma, biotech, and sort of have that commercial lens in industry. And then phase three was, there were so many incredible startups and opportunities to start companies. That was another thing that really inspired me. So all to say, phase one worked out and I was really excited about the offer I got from the Boston Consulting Group. So accepted that, finished my PhD, and the rest is history.
That's fantastic. And the three-pronged strategy really resonates. That's better career planning than most of us had. Okay, so you joined BCG and you're interested in innovation and commercialization. So how does that manifest in your work?
Part of why I chose BCG is the innovative culture. In all of our casework with clients, there's always an emphasis on what does the future look like in the next 5-10 years, and how can we help our clients to be competitive in those futures? So, of course, with my healthcare background, I gravitated towards the healthcare practice as my first focus. And over the first few years, really discovered a passion for corporate strategy, and even further, how you incorporate a financial lens into strategic planning. So not only do we want to be a great company and do good, but how do we get credit for that to enable additional research, additional good in the world through shareholder return and valuation? So that's what led me to this corporate finance practice area. And within that, mm-hmm. the topic of innovation is a key driver of long-term advantage.
Can you give us just sort of a sketch, obviously anonymous, of the kinds of clients you have? So within healthcare, like, are these drug companies or hospital chains? Are they big, small? I mean, you mentioned shareholder returns. So I presume some, if not most, are publicly traded.
Exactly. It's primarily public companies among the Fortune 500, 1000, really depends. And within the healthcare practice, we cover all of those sectors. So we have payers, providers, med tech, biopharma, and global health, and to an increasing extent, health tech. So digital mm-hmm. natives that are moving into the healthcare space.
Well, that's actually a very broad purview.
Yes. And so to focus that a little bit with my focus on med tech and biopharma, it narrows it a little bit, but still I'd say it feels a little broad and yet it keeps it really exciting for me. So med tech in particular will include things like medical devices, digital health, health IT, so like revenue cycle management, EMR, mm-hmm. EHR, genetic sequencing services, which I do quite a bit of work in, and diagnostics. And then biopharma, it starts to overlap with things like cell and gene therapies and your classic large pharma companies.
And is part of your role also thinking about, keeping an eye on, for example, acquisition opportunities for your clients where you have to kind of keep a bead on the up-and-comers or who's doing exciting work out there?
Absolutely. So that's a really exciting space where we have a lot of internal capabilities and functions that we'll deploy to help our large clients to get a view of the entire landscape of startups and early stage companies. So our BCG Center for Growth and Innovation Analytics, for example, mm-hmm. is where we leverage AI and machine learning tools to look at total investment across the landscape of a given topic over the past few years. Who are the biggest players in terms of rising companies and also those who are investing as potential competitors? So yeah, that's some of my favorite work is doing that sort of stuff.
Very cool. On the theme of innovation, so BCG just today, at the time of recording, I believe, launched its 50 most innovative companies list. And this is more than a listicle. Tell us about this sort of program or this designation that you guys have come up with.
Yeah, definitely. So this is really a favorite project of mine. Incredible effort that goes into this report each year. This is our 17th year of the most innovative companies report. And like you were saying, its capstone is the top 50 list of companies, but behind it is quite an in-depth report on the state of innovation and what innovation leaders are doing today. And the intention is to develop this for all audiences. So from startups mm-hmm. and students to executives at Fortune 500 to really see like what issues should we be thinking about. So for example, this year we've been looking at AI, of course, is the top conversation topic of the year and what our company is doing there, but also with our economic uncertainty and broader macro environmental variables, like what are people doing with innovation given that context?
I have two questions. One is, how do you find these companies, right? So is this something where companies are nominated or self-nominated, or is this just based, again, on your team's research? But the more interesting question to me is actually, how do you measure innovation? How do you think about actually coming up with the ranking?
Yeah. So let me tell you what the methodology is today and sort of how we think about measuring innovation. It's related, but maybe separate topics. So the ranking today, and I think we modified it slightly in 2020, but it's been more or less the same for the past 17 years. It's calculated based on four variables, which are largely driven by a global double-blinded innovation survey that we run every year with over 1,000 innovation executives for 75% of the score. And then 25% of the score is the value creation of the individual companies, so their shareholder return. And if they're not public companies, then we use relevant index for the market that they're playing in. So unlike other lists, where companies can apply to be considered, and in some cases even pay to be on the list. It's not BCG's perspective. It's not, companies trying to access or pay to play. It's purely this double-blinded survey that really drives the majority of the score.
And just for our listeners, this can be found at mic.bcg.com, and we will put the link in our show notes. I'm scrolling now. It does look like a really kind of spectacular list with a lot of names, brand names I recognize, but also I would say some real kind of up-and-comers or folks maybe I wouldn't have expected to be on the list. And across all industries, lots of industries are represented here.
Yeah, and tech is often the lead industry in terms of representation on the list of top 50. But notably this year, we saw a rise in the number of healthcare companies and predominantly biotech, biopharma and medtech companies. But I think last year there were four, this year there's six. And they're also notably higher on the list. So if you check that out, you can kind of celebrate the healthcare representation.
To what extent do you think these companies have sort of deliberate strategy around innovation versus, they just happen to be kind of big powerhouses, so they landed here? Do you get into that in the report about how the companies themselves prioritize innovation as a differentiator?
Yes, definitely. In the survey, where, of course, it's blinded, so we cannot confirm what respondents are part of the companies that are in the top 50. But we do have metrics within our survey to say, who are the innovation leaders? So when we look at who the leaders are, 80% cite innovation among their top three strategic priorities. And this has always been a high number. It's particularly high this year, but it's always been well above 50%. And so they're deliberately incorporating innovation into their strategic plans and investment allocations, knowing that that's a key driver of value creation in the long term and quite often in the short term as well.
You mentioned that for some of these companies, maybe all of them, artificial intelligence has to be among their innovation priorities. I feel like all verticals are feeling this. But since you have a focus in sort of the med tech and biopharma space, where do you see AI kind of currently actually making an impact, sort of already in deployment in, through your lens?
And specifically in the healthcare space.
Yeah, let's maybe refocus. I'm noticing this list has companies, of all kinds. I don't want to ruin it for people, but, Apple's number one, for example, right? So, and I think in some number of years, we will take it for granted that Apple will also be a healthcare company, right? I mean, they've got certainly an app ecosystem with digital health and a lot of the tech companies made, but let's focus on maybe what folks, listeners think of more traditionally as biopharma, but also med tech and health tech, where your work is focused. Where do you see AI making the biggest impact?
So healthcare is really an exciting space for AI. And I probably don't need to tell this audience that statement. If you're listening to this, you probably agree. But if you look at across industries, where the impact is expected to manifest for AI, healthcare is the top industry. I think it's right behind banking and financial services and insurance as a topic, but behind that, healthcare is really driving the edge of AI applications and the ability to really see impact on the landscape and also in terms of business value. Specifically, use cases in healthcare, and let's talk biopharma, medtech, the entire value chain is being disrupted. So starting at the very early stage of R&D development and identification of drug targets and potential candidates and optimizing those and the whole development process, all the way through to the operations of pharma companies and how they manufacture and process orders and the supply chain, how do you get those products out to patients? And then from the provider perspective, how they're making decisions to treat patients individually and eventually getting to this world of precision medicine where there's a lot of companies, of course, looking at personalized cell and gene therapies, and how do you drive provider decision-making of all the options that are out there? And then finally, when we're looking at patient care, remote patient monitoring, and how do you continue care in the home as more care shifts from acute settings to non-acute and ultimately hospital at home. So I mean, all that to say, there's like a huge range of places that are truly going to be disrupted with AI. But mm-hmm. I'd say the leading edge is around drug discovery and the virtual care application. Those two, when we look at, like I mm-hmm. mentioned, our growth and innovation analytics team, from their analyses, those are the two spaces where there's mm-hmm. the most investment and activity by far.
That's fascinating. I was just last week at the annual members meeting for the Alliance for AI and Healthcare, which was being hosted by Roche Genentech on their South San Francisco campus. And I was chairing a panel on software as a medical device, you know, which would probably capture some of the virtual care stuff you're talking about. But what was interesting to me is on the first day, it was actually someone on the drug discovery panel who just posited that he thinks the first sort of real patient impact of AI in healthcare will actually be on the SAMD side, on the software as a medical device and virtual care side, because it touches patients. You know, even if you have an AI discovered drug, it still has a ways to go before it touches a patient. And some of those ways will be enabled by AI as well. But, you know, just in terms of the temporal impact, you know, the med tech stuff is really, really tightly coupled with actual care of patients.
Definitely. And we've seen so much activity already too on the digital therapeutic side, and mm-hmm. how pharma companies are driving and leading some of that development. Actually, our BCGX Ventures team has helped a few clients in the pharma space in terms of their strategy for digital care and also building tools themselves and how those pair with existing pharma products as a broad continuum of care. Like it's the whole patient beyond the pill, so to speak.
So you would kind of, you know, alluded to this idea of a world of precision medicine and personalized medicines, you know, which are similar but subtly different. And I believe, and part of the reason for the podcast is that artificial intelligence will enable a world in which those two paradigms are much more prevalent. But there has to be some economic levers too. And this is challenging for companies like ours. You know, a drug company may not be incentivized to have a biomarker for its drug if they can get away with regulatory approvals for everybody, right? You get a broader label and can sell it to more people. So do you see the main drivers towards precision and personalized medicine being sort of revenue opportunity, like, you know, adopters from the ground up, or do you see it as being regulatory based and sort of a top-down values-based care lever, or will the truth lie somewhere in between?
It's a great question. I think from my perspective, and part of why I love working in the healthcare space, is that yes, a lot of strategic decisions are driven by, you know, revenue growth or margin expansion and ultimately share return, but it's also about the patients. And it's really wonderful when I work with clients across the space that like they really do think about the patients and how do we better serve the population. So, you know, let's be a good company, do good, but also be a good stock and drive value. I think I might have mentioned earlier too. Mm-hmm. So I think both of those lenses are driving the shift to precision personalized medicine applications. And it's also a way to reduce the costs, total cost of care for a mm-hmm. provider perspective. So a reason to partner across the stakeholder groups.
That's actually a very refreshing answer. I mean, I had posited it could be, you know, profits driving it or regulators cracking the whip, right? And this has been my experience as well, working with lots of drug companies. Every person I've met, their motivation is to deliver for patients, right? So the idea that that's actually the reason why we will adopt some of these paradigms is to deliver better outcomes, because that's the whole reason we're doing this in the first place.
Right. From a revenue perspective, it's also a positive because it often enables you to reach a broader patient population. So of the huge percent of patients that are not treatable today or have very low prognosis of survival, mm-hmm. this offers an opportunity to have something for them. So that's good for business and it's good for the society.
So things like drug development and certainly virtual care and SAMD, these are highly regulated environments. And right now, there's a lot of hubbub about artificial intelligence and the need to regulate it. So last week, also, maybe it was the week before, were congressional hearings with some of the leaders of leading tech companies developing AI tools. And, you know, this has come to a fever pitch because of, I think, the popularity and ubiquity of tools like ChatGPT, right? So public-facing large language models, which are cool, but kind of scary. And so now, of course, the lawmakers are playing catch up. Of note, there was not a single healthcare company represented on Capitol Hill. How do you see the regulatory landscape of AI evolving? Do you see AI, at least in healthcare, being able to be regulated by existing healthcare regulatory bodies, or is there going to be something else? And, you know, we're going to have to fight for compatibilities between, you know, whatever Congress does and the FDA and so forth.
I'm not a regulatory expert, so I can't say, you know, what should the end state look like or how should we get there. But I can speak to two themes that come up quite a bit when I'm talking with clients and, you know, the projecting into the future in terms of what dimensions are likely to impact our world, you know, 5-10 years down the road as, you know, pharma clients are building AI applications and working on their products. And so the two issues are, you know, cybersecurity and health equity. How are we going to have to think about those? And of course, like, there's a desire to address those issues and, you know, build it into early applications, but it's also extremely challenging. And especially for smaller companies that don't have the same resources as a Fortune 500 mm-hmm. company to build in the capabilities for cybersecurity, protect patient data, and also to access the patients across a diverse population to really have coverage. Those are extremely hard things to do. And so to one extent, will regulatory be able to drive a movement towards those pieces, and or you know, how might that be challenging for players and maybe necessitate partnerships and more like network efforts across the space. But yeah, I really think like from a cybersecurity perspective, with the expansion of data on patients and the need for privacy, there's a view of like, how can patients control what data gets shared with whom mm-hmm. and when, and how does it get used? And you know, the FDA has already raised the bar on cybersecurity for medical devices. And then on the health equity side, how do we encourage inclusion for clinical trials across a broad population? And AI will play a key role here in accessing patients and making it easier to collect that data.
Yeah, no, I really hope that's the case. This is a big focus of ours at the Alliance for AI and Healthcare, and also a focus of ours within Genialis is thinking about step one is acknowledging the bias in data, both bias data and bias with regards to data gaps, right? Underrepresented populations. Women are maybe the most obvious and perniciously underrepresented in healthcare data, but given that you make up 50% of the population, but then you can obviously break into ethnicities and geographies that are also underrepresented. So I hope that your prediction is true, that AI tools can be deployed to, you know, to the benefit and to the service of equity. There is, of course, a strain of popular concern that it'll have the opposite effect, that it'll just enable those who are already rich enough to do it the way they want to keep all the goodies. How do you think innovative companies can try to help keep a level playing field, right? Can try to make sure that these products are, in fact, used to expand reach?
Yeah, this raises the topic of responsible AI. You're absolutely right. I totally agree. There's a huge risk that AI just it amplifies the disparities in healthcare representation and opportunities even more. And so we have to be extremely deliberate in how we build AI tools to incorporate equity. And so as I think about responsible AI, like it's so challenging because I see a lot of clients maybe at one time had a team focused or at least a person thinking about responsible AI approaches. But given our macro environmental context, it's also a place that gets cut when companies are being pushed to, you know, unfortunately cut deep in terms of their capabilities or investment mm-hmm. into programs. And so I would urge that, I think this is also something that BCG covers in quite a lot of depth. If you look up, we have a team focused on responsible AI and a lot of publications on the topic with advice on what biopharma and you know, broader healthcare players can do. But it's critical to at least have that lens at the table as we're developing these new tools and piloting them and deploying them. And maybe a second thought on that piece is like form coalitions. So it sounds like mm-hmm. Raphael, like with your group thinking about what should the rules be? What are the guidelines? What are the standardizations, like measures mm-hmm. that we can incorporate as people are building tools in all different places? How can we help each other to ensure that what we're building is responsible to society?
Yeah, no, I think public-private partnerships and industry organizations must emerge, are emerging, right? The AAH is one. There are others. I'd love to see more patient voices brought into that. But, you know, I think even with the meteoric rise of AI, I think it's still a little esoteric for a lot of patients to really kind of grasp what their voice is going to be. So we as the tech leaders need to make sure they're at the table as well. But no, I think it'll be interesting to see how this gets regulated. And again, it would be neat if AI and healthcare gets handled smartly by the existing healthcare regulation. It doesn't maybe get handcuffed by whatever may come for big tech companies. I think the use cases are rather different. You know, healthcare is a space where you can't, quote, move fast and break things.
Exactly. We have to be very thoughtful. And in these high regulatory, high control industries, it's important to work together as well.
I want to shift a little bit more back to the topic of your work. Just on this call, I've learned so much about some of the areas that BCG covers, and the fact that you've got a team focused on responsible AI, you know, warms the cockles of my heart. Tell me a little bit more about the day-to-day of your work, but also where you see having an impact on your clients and on the industry. You know, what is the role that companies like BCG and others, you know, who are also focused on this, have in kind of shaping the future?
When I start a conversation with a client, often, you know, a client reaches out to us, or we have relationships with a lot of our clients for many, many years. Usually the topic that we are brought in on is around strategy. What should we focus on in the next 5 to 10 years? How should we allocate our capital and investments in order to maintain a strong position? But even more importantly, like, how do we grow and have an impact on the world in the way that they want in their mission statement and vision? So the type of work that I often support will be helping to create a fact base of what's happening in the world. What are the variables that will impact the future? And often a few scenarios of what the future might look like. Imagine the world in 2030. Mm-hmm. Here is what's likely to happen. And there have been a few instances where we've even played out war games and facilitated workshops where it's, okay, if you know, regulatory does this, and then your competitor does this, like, now what do you do? And it really helps bring to life what could happen in the world and what your competitive advantages are. So in one example that comes to mind, it really, we played out three different scenarios of very different world paths, and that we've discovered a common denominator of, no matter what happens, we have these advantages in terms of our data access, our digital capabilities, the way we support our patients, which will look slightly different in each world view, but fundamentally, you know, it helps to elucidate what is the competitive advantage. And so that's part of what we're helping clients to see, is like, what is their unique value add to the world, and how can they allocate their capital in a way that makes for a good company, a good business, aligns with investor expectations or expectations of their target investors. In some cases, the current investor set is not necessarily what they would want to target, and we can help shift that dynamic as well. And then finally, from a financial perspective, like, are, by doing these things, are you going to achieve financial goals around revenue growth or margins that helps the company to survive and ultimately be able to reinvest into all the good work that they are driving as part of the mission?
I have a question that's a bit of a non sequitur, but stemming from that, you know, the last year and a half, going on 2 years, have been tough in the biotech industry, at least for smaller companies, you know, with newly IPO'd biotechs or private, you know, small cap biotechs. It's really just been a year and a half, the market downturn, but it's been down. And so my question is, do you see companies either in your portfolio or just in your broader lens holding back on innovation because they just can't afford it right now? Or do you see most of them maintaining those investments, realizing that there will be a brighter day and they don't want to lose their edge?
That's a great question and a really interesting dynamic that you see play out differently for the smaller companies versus the larger ones. Since I'm working primarily with large companies, we have the privilege of, in most cases, a very strong balance sheet with cash on hand to make strategic moves in a downturn. So a lot of the advice and conversations that we're having with clients are around, like, okay, what acquisitions can we make? What investments can we make? Because technology is cheap and this is an opportunity to expand your portfolio and enter new markets, new technology spaces, and even acquire a talented team of with capabilities. So from a large company perspective, that's kind of been the dynamic. And in our survey, the innovation survey for the innovation report, we found almost 70% of companies, and these are large companies, the cutoff is a minimum of 10 million in revenue, annual revenue, but majority are a lot larger than that. But 70% are planning to increase their spend in 2023 relative to last year for R&D and innovation focused projects. So they're not holding back. They're not scaling down. Companies are increasing because they know in times like these where uncertainty is high, we're potentially heading towards a downturn. It's important to balance both short-term and long-term objectives. So while in the short term, it's about, you know, maintaining resilience and margin protection and supply chain resilience. But in the long term, technology is evolving so fast. If you're not innovating, you're going to fall behind. So they have to be investing in innovation and carefully in deliberate domain with a very clear and focused strategy, so that return on investment is very clear.
You've talked a lot about sort of long-term vision, but let me just ask you to look in the near-term crystal ball. Do you see the biotech markets turning upwards soon? Do you see sort of the IPO windows thawing in the near future, or are we in for a long winter?
It's so hard to say. So I won't.
Yeah, I'm not going to hold you to this.
I'm not going to commit. I can't commit. I will commit, though, to the certainty of uncertainty. More than ever in the past, in 2023, and over the past few years, it's been rising. Just there's so many variables driving uncertainty that I could not possibly predict even where are we going to be in 5 years. So, you know, we're bracing for a downturn. We're bracing for who knows what the world's going to throw at us next. This is not like the past recession in 2009. Like that was a clear, okay, there's some short-term goals and focus, and we got through that. But this is like, okay, like there's a lot of fighting for survival, but also knowing that we have to focus on the long term. And so we know that there's going to be uncertainty. We know that at some point, like, the economy will bounce back. We can be optimistic with that, but let's figure out how to partner effectively and take advantage of what moves can we make given the macro environment right now and still make progress on these important issues.
All right. Non-market question, but the last one, because again, you ask your clients to imagine the world 20 years out. Give me a prediction, not even a prediction, just a vision. This would be nice if 10, 20 years out, an innovation in healthcare that's really helping people. What do you see? What would you like to see?
That's such a fun question. So I would love to just swim in this, like, what's the wish list of what the world will look like? And I personally am so excited about unlocking the human genome. We're far past that first genome sequencing, and now more and more learning about the function of different genes and how does that inform, you know, individual patient likelihood of survival in different disease states, and just how we can improve the standard of healthcare. But similar to when we look, you know, 100 years ago and we think, oh my goodness, we were in the dark ages then, I am excited for, I guess, you know, maybe it's not 100 years in the future, but even closer than that, we'll look back at 2023 and think, man, we are living in the dark ages with the advancements that we're going to see in terms of being able to treat patients individually for their unique disease states and not being so afraid of the unknown. While we do recognize certain, you know, cancers, for example, in oncology, such a huge space today, we're still learning so much about what's going on. There's so much that's unpredictable. So just having a little bit more visibility into how biology works and our ability to work with that is what I'm most excited about. And then, of course, overlaying all of that, enabling all of that, is digital. So how are we using data and AI and digital capabilities to support the entire value chain of care, from discovery in biopharma to supporting patients in their home and everything in between? So those are the things that I really get excited about.
Well, that's a great place to end it. I share your enthusiasm for that future. Amy McDougall, thank you so much for joining us today. And I look forward to reading the whole report and one day putting Genialis on that list of 50 most innovative companies.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Rafael.
This has been Talking Precision Medicine. Please share it with your colleagues, leave a comment or review, and stay tuned for the next episode. Thanks for joining the conversation.